So let's continue our meeting. And before we're doing that, I personally feel that, okay, so far the discussions which we had were very fruitful. And at least on the technical discussions, I think it gives observers and us a lot of insight and guidance. So thank you very much, all of you, for that. And having that said, we come now to another difficult discussion, which is coverage units. And I give the word to Anne.
Thank you. So Agenda Paper 5 addresses a submission we received on how to determine coverage units. So coverage units are used to allocate the CSM to periods of service, and therefore they determine how much of the CSM is recognised in profit or loss in any period. The submission notes that because of the variety in insurance products, there's quite a lot of questions coming up about how we should determine coverage units. Some of the examples in the submission relate to insurance contracts with investment components, and we plan to address issues relating to contracts with investment components at a later meeting. We thought it would be helpful if we could establish some basic principles without thinking about investment components first, then that might help move us forward. The submission identifies different factors that might be included in the determination of coverage units. To help apply the requirements of IFRS 17, the paper slightly regroups those factors, and it sets out in paragraph 7 of the paper how we're going to look at them. And so the factors are, firstly, variability across periods in the level of cover that's provided by contracts in the group. And then the second set of factors is the likelihood of an insured event occurring. And we've divided that into two aspects. Firstly, to the extent that it affects the expected duration of a contract. And secondly, to the extent that it affects the amounts expected to be claimed in any period. We have analysed the requirements of IFRS 17 and looked at the reasoning in the basis, and we've concluded, and our conclusions are set out in paragraph 17 of the paper on these factors. So if I firstly deal with the ones that I think are more straightforward, and that's the factors in 7B of the paper, so the likelihood of an insured event occurring. And we think that it's clear from the words in B119A of IFRS 17 that to the extent that the likelihood of an insured event occurring affects the expected duration of a contract, we would expect to see that included in the determination of the coverage units. That's what the standard says. And we also think it's clear from the paragraph in the basis, BC279A, that the extent to which the likelihood of an event occurring affects the amount expected to be claimed in any period, that we wouldn't include that in our determination of coverage units, because paragraph BC279A rejects the use of expected cash flows in a period for a pattern of CSM release. So that leaves the more tricky bit, which is, should we be reflecting variability in the level of cover provided in different periods by the contracts in the group? And in particular, we've concluded that yes, it should, because one of the important things we were trying to do with coverage units was to distinguish between contracts of different sizes. And we think it's consistent to say, you know, if you've got a contract that's providing more cover compared to a contract providing less cover, it's consistent with that idea to also think about different levels of cover being provided in different periods of time. We then went on to say that in determining what that level of cover is in each period, that should reflect the contractual maximum level of cover. And we decided on that rather than looking at the expected level of cover, taking into account expected events other than the likelihood of an insured claim. So if there were other things that were affecting the level of cover. And we thought about whether those expectations should be included in this determination of the level of cover over time. But we decided that, based again on the words in BC 279, and also the discussion in B18 of IFRS 17, which I'm sorry isn't reproduced in the paper, but it talks about significant insurance risk and explains you can have a significant insurance risk even if the probability weighted amount is small, so that even if the insured event is unlikely, even if the effect on the fulfillment cash flows, the probability weighted expected value is small, that could still give rise to significant insurance risk, and therefore we think it could affect the amount of cover that you're providing. And because of that, we thought that although people might argue that using the maximum contractual level of cover could be arbitrary in some cases, because you could set a maximum level of cover that you never expected to hit. But if there were a scenario in which you could, and that would result in a significant loss, then that gives you more insurance risk. So, in conclusion, we decided that you should take into account variability in the level of cover over periods of time, and that should be based on the maximum contractual level of cover. I'll hand it over to you, but in order to structure the discussion, we'd like to get views on your analysis in the paper and the conclusions in paragraph 17 first, then talk about the application of those conclusions to the examples, and then finally return to some practical aspects of the conclusions that we've noted in paragraphs 19 and 20. So if we could get your views on what we've set out as being the principles first, and then we'll talk about how they apply to the examples.
Okay, thanks, Anne. Then we go to Anne.
So just referring to the principles first, I think the first one around the likelihood of the insured event and the expected duration of the contract, that one made sense. That is consistent. And just for background, we are currently a general insurer, almost entirely a general insurer. A lot of the business is going to be pretty much straight line, but there's quite a rump of business where it's complex and complicated commercial risks. And we've got lenders' mortgage business in Australia, which is up 20, 30 years of potential coverage. So we've got quite a number of products where we've been looking at this exact issue. So to your principles, in terms of the expected duration, that made sense to look at that as one of the principles. I didn't agree with the way you were looking at the level of cover. I think it was inappropriate to look at the maximum cover. I think you need to really consider one of the other issues that you brought up in the paper as a principle, but then didn't use it in your list of principles, which was a valid claim. So I think that you have to be cognizant of whether there is actually the possibility, the ability to pay a valid claim by the insured to the insured. And a good example, and I know you want to come back to the examples, but the construction contract is a good example of that, where you can have a period where there is no insurable asset there, and therefore no valid claim could be paid, and yet you've just adopted the maximum level of cover. That level of cover was written into the contract to be a maximum cap to stop losses and to protect capital. It wasn't written in there to reflect the standing by ready to provide insurance service, so I think you've picked on something which is not relevant to the actual insurance service that we're trying to reflect in the coverage unit. I just wanted to pick up also the other thing I think that is coming through with these principles is probably more in the way you've applied them. And the issue I think we've gone back to is the one that coverage units was brought in to resolve anyway, which was, I think the first version was flat line standing ready, and then it was looking at numbers of contracts. And then coverage units came in so you could actually start to get a better pattern of the delivery of service. But when I looked at the examples that you've put down here, the selections that the staff have made in terms of which is the right service, the right coverage pattern isn't what we would select. So, for example, in the ADC, you'll have a lot more claims being paid in the early years. You will have a lot less claims paid in the later years. If you applied the flatline approach, you're going to be actually carrying forward profit into periods where there's very little service expected to be delivered at all. So that one stuck out as not being the right answer when you apply those principles. I think the key in there is that when you get to construction, I've talked about the period at the beginning where you really don't have the ability to pay a valid claim. There are very complex commercial construction contracts where you're looking at multiple projects that are running alongside each other. There could be periods in there where there is actually no construction work taking place. So I think you need to recognise that there are very complicated products, and that actually insurers are, or general insurers are already looking at the patterns of incidence of risk in terms of those contracts. So it isn't a big step for them to understand and to be able to define what the appropriate patterns of service are, aside from the risk. And there was only two other things I wanted to point out. One was in paragraphs 16 and 17, I was a bit concerned because you picked up on the PAA eligibility and stated that it was based on the profit, the recognition of profit, whereas actually the test for PAA eligibility is around the liability for remaining coverage. So I was a bit concerned that we're bringing in some new concepts into this paper that we were very comfortable with. And actually, this is, and these are obviously my views from my experience in general, but these were a consensus across the global, the Australian TRG as well, from all sectors. And actually, what we wanted to do was ask you to retract the paper and to actually consider this again and consider it in light of the other investment type products that you're looking at, because we think some of the answers here are just not correct.
Okay, before we...
Could I just say, on the PAA, we weren't implying anything about how you assess contracts for the PAA, and the footnote was meant to indicate that, you know, all we're saying is you have to assess whether the contract is eligible for the PAA considering all the facts and circumstances. The fact that you get a different profit recognition may or may not affect that.
I guess the concern is once you write that into papers, it can get taken beyond the paper and try to be put into practice. And it really just isn't relevant to the issue at stake, which is the one of coverage units. So we thought that was unnecessary. But there was quite a good consensus across the Australian industry that this really didn't hit the mark in terms of the practical examples. But there were some relatively good concepts in there in terms of the principles around a valid claim and around that duration.
I mean, the examples were the ones that were submitted. So they were the ones we looked at.
Roman?
Thank you. Before I start to dig into some of the principles discussed in the paper, as a kind of disclaimer, I must say I understand the approach that we start now with insurance coverage and then add more complex products going forward in one of the next TRG sessions. However, this is also dangerous that we take some conclusions which are generalized, which somehow limit the discussions we need to have then on the more complex stuff. We'll have multiple services, insurance services, investment services, and maybe even other services which you need to assess in combination to depict then the right level of CSM release to reflect the services provided. So I think it's good that we start the discussion, but it can only, from my perspective, only be a starting point, but it's difficult to draw conclusions at that point in time on specific examples without considering the whole picture. So a piecemeal approach is dangerous, and that was something raised in different groups, also in the German associations. Then I'm going into the paper, and I understand I'm asked now to first comment on the principles you set up instead of the examples. I must say I have a little bit of a problem with that approach in general, because I thought that we are applying then the standard on concrete examples, and by that somehow giving our view of how to read the standard, I think what the staff paper now does, and there are a lot of good things in, I'm not saying that the conclusions are, cannot support partly, but indirectly we are, or directly we, the staff paper now is developing additional principles on a generic level without the connection to the examples, so narrowing down, I think, the words of the standard, developing additional principles. And if I go into the discussion on the quantity of benefits, I think that is the core part of the discussion. Paragraph 7 identifies then the level of cover and likelihood of an insured event as relevant factors for the quantity of benefits. And then the paper concludes that the likelihood of an insured event should only be reflected in case it affects expected duration, because expected duration is explicitly mentioned in the B, I think 190. But not if it only affects the amount expected to be paid in a period. And going then one step further, this implies then that the level of cover is only determinant for the quantity of benefits. And I think that is a conclusion, which is a generic conclusion. If the ISB had wanted that, they would have directly referred to level of cover in the standard. But in the standard, it's not level of cover, but quantity of benefits. So my reverse conclusion would be quantity of benefits can be more than just level of cover. I would not agree that we can narrow down quantity of benefits to level of cover only. Might be very often level of cover, but there might be situations where there's something else next to level of cover. And then going one step deeper on the level of cover, the limitation to the contractual maximum level of cover in each period, which is set out as a principle, clearly can be adequate in many situations, but it will be too narrow in many other cases. And we are not going to the examples, but one example I would directly reference to is the fire insurance example, where I think the outcome, I would not agree. So again, if the ISB had wanted that the contractual maximum limit is the only possible interpretation of cover, then they would have written it directly in the standard, and then we don't need a lot of discussion on that. But it's not the case. So again, I would not agree that this can be drawn from the standard, this generic principle. So that is my first statement without going over the examples.
Thanks, Roman. Dara?
I had a question for Anne, I think, to start with, and just so I want to understand the specific example that you gave. I think you used an acronym, but I think is that the mortgage products? I'm talking about where the business is used, where it's used.
That was ADC, wasn't it?
ADC was the one I talked about. Which is the ADC, one of the examples in here.
The question I wanted to ask you was whether you're in discussing this in Australia, whether you had discussed products which have a very different, like a life product, where a lot of the claims are expected towards the end, whether that had been discussed in the context of the same thing. In thinking about likelihood of claim, which would seem to be where you were getting to.
Likelihood of claims, you start to get into the whole likelihood of risk, and that's where we've avoided. So we have been looking at what the when you take away the reference to risk, what are you left with? What cover are you providing? So we have referenced the existence of the insurable asset. So in the case of the life covers, if there is an insurable asset that's there in the later part of the coverage period, there would still be some service. But the example here, which was the adverse development cover, is quite the opposite way around. So where you're looking at towards the end of the coverage period, having a very minimal insurable asset, very minimal benefits and likelihood of the claims occurring, or benefits, being provided, and therefore you would expect that there to be a tail off and not a flat line cover, whereas this was just taking the maximum ADC aggregate limit and applying it evenly over the whole period. And when you compare that to things like the reason why coverage units were brought in, which is to reflect lapses, you know, it's not a dissimilar concept that we're actually running off these claims and they're being paid out, and you would expect far less of the benefits to be there in the future and therefore less service to be provided.
Could I just clarify how we thought that example would work? Because I've had conversations with other people that have made it clear that it's not clear what we've put in the paper. So, in sorry, this is getting into the examples. So, if we look at paragraph A13, which talks about. So, at the beginning of. You've got a contract that's going to last 5 years, and you can claim up to 100 over those 5 years. So at the beginning, you have no reason, you know, to believe that there's anything other than an uneven provision of cover. But then, at the end of the first reporting period, you would reassess. This is why I've put in that you reassess the expected duration of the contract. You also would reassess the amount of cover that you have left. So say in the first year, you'd out of the 100, you'd met a claim of 20. So you would say, well, in that first year, I was standing ready for cover of 100. At the end of the year, though, in the future, I've only got cover of 80 left. So you say, I've got 4 years still to go with cover now down to 80. So you'd say, I've provided cover standing ready for 100 in the first year. I've got 4 years left of providing cover up to 80. So you'd say, I've provided cover of 100, and then what's to be provided in the future is 4 times 80, so 320. And that would determine how much of the CSM you would release. So the difference between a situation where you've got a cumulative limit compared to one where you've just got a limit for each year, say up to 100 each year, is that if you've got just up to 100 each year, the level of cover is affected only by the passage of time as you go through each period. But if it's a cumulative limit, then the level of cover that is left in the contract is affected not just by the passage of time and the using up of a period, but it's also affected by the fact that you've used some of that cover and it's not available to use in the future. And I realise now, looking at paragraph A13, that was not explained clearly, but that is what we were saying. So in your case, Anne, where you were using up the cover by making claims, you would see a declining level of coverage units yet to be provided under the contract.
Okay, William.
Yeah, thank you. As I was reading through the paper and thinking about the principles that you were describing here, they seemed to make sense. And then when I got to the examples, I was really struggling to see the application of that, especially thinking of it in the terms of groups of contracts, because it seemed like some of the examples ended up getting down to the contract level. But when I thought about it in terms of a group of contracts, you know, I think that there's going to be a range of expected durations when those policies go off the books. And so in the example you just gave, where you have the 100 cover in the first year and then potentially 80 in the rest of the year or the other 3 years, I understand that from a single contract point of view, but from a group of contracts, I certainly wouldn't expect that I'm going to be providing 80 in each of those periods. And if I was reassessing the amount of cover I was going to be providing for that group of contracts, it would have a declining pattern. And so as I was starting to think about the examples, and as you got to this expected duration notion and tying it to a probability weighted duration, which sounds to me like a single number or a single period, that is very likely to be less than the full coverage period.
Yes.
Yes.
When you come up with that number.
Yes.
How do you end up then allocating CSM over the full coverage period? Except that period keeps increasing every time you make a reevaluation.
Exactly. So you reassess. And if you, in fact, have got to the end of the life of the contract for whatever reason, then you have nothing left in the future. But if you have... if your expected duration has in fact extended because either it's got a cumulative limit and you haven't claimed as much as you thought you would, or for whatever reason. So you are always reassessing at the end of the reporting period what the expected duration of the contracts in the group is in order to determine what coverage units will be you expect to provide in the future.
So in order to make an estimation of the duration,
yeah,
we need to come up with effectively a distribution of when those policies are expected to block.
Yes.
Why is a single expected duration, so you already know the pattern that you would expect those to go off the books.
Yeah.
By using the expected duration, you're eventually moving to that pattern over time. It's the pattern you would realize if your whole estimate worked out. But you would have front-ended the amortization of the CSM.
I don't think you end up front-ending. So if I understand correctly where you're coming from, William, I think what you're essentially saying is that when I think about that contract of 180, 80, 80, 80, that may be, I have an expected average duration of 5 and an expected average future quantity of benefits, quantity of cover of 80 per period, and I do it that way. Alternatively, I could get to the same answer by saying I have an expectation of 90, 85, et cetera, going out for 20 years, where the last couple of years are just 10. This is not trying to measure the specific level of cover of each year in the future. That's not relevant. The only thing that's relevant here is the current period versus all of the cumulative future periods, because that's what tells me what goes into the current period versus what I have to hold back for the future. So I think I could do it both ways and get to the same outcome. But we're probably back to the same point of saying we have to be careful of the simplifications and examples. But the specific objective, I think others have touched on, of coverage units here, is the idea that what I've got is I've got a whole lot of contracts in there. I want to assess this year versus all of the future years in a context of size. And there are a number of different tools that I can use to actually do that. But I guess the big question here is I need some kind of benchmark, and I guess what we're trying to talk about is what is that benchmark? What is the thing that I'm looking at?
Lily?
Yes, John, I quite agree with Roman. I think when we read the standard, we think it's okay for the coverage unit or quantity of benefits, but it seems in the papers it says the maximum level of coverage is one of the key concerns and staff using to. Looking at those simple samples, that might be the case, but when we come back to the reality, we have lots of complicated issues. Just like you said, that you have maximum 100 and then 80, that's okay, but if we look at the first issue paper we just discussed in the morning, because you combine lots of different insurance coverage into one contract. For example, I have one contract that have 100 million for accident, and then 100,000 for accident, and then 10,000 for just health care. Mm-hmm. And which one you use? You use 100 or you use 10, or you add them together. And if there's a claim one day that for the accident you down to 90, if you use someone, the 10 is not changed. Mm. Or if there are some cases, the 100 is not changed, and this 10 go to 5. So you have very different, because it's two coverage, different risk, and we don't think it's okay to add them together. So in those cases, it will make things quite complicated to consider. And also we have some cases, for example, that you have a payment period, for example, 10 years. During that period, you either have no coverage at all, or you have some like term lifetime coverage for a certain amount. And then you have we call a silent period, that there's no payment at all. And after your retirement, you start to have annuity. Mm-hmm. So this one, should we look at them separately for CSM allocation, or we look at the whole contract in whole? So that will be a complicated issue as well. We look at your cases. And also we have an example for like universal life insurance contracts we have the policyholder have the right to pay certain amount of premium, small amount, to add up their coverage, and but we don't know when and how they will make add up. So it will be difficult to estimate for the future coverage in that cases. So I think one term we really don't like the maximum level of coverage to be in your paper to look to us is to be one good practice or best practice to follow. And also I think the samples there, although I said I don't like samples, but the samples there seem to be too simple. If you need to follow that, you probably need to gather lots of different samples and to consider what is a good way to deal.
I mean, I would agree that if you have got different types of cover in your, you know, in your group, then it is going to be more complicated to assess the coverage units than if you only have one type of cover, and you are going to have to find, I mean, I think the principles in IFRS 17 would be that you do have to find a way of assessing, you know, what cover in total, what service are you providing in total by these different forms of cover.
But in real life, there's never been simple cases.
We thought that going for a maximum level of cover rather than a sort of what you would expect, excluding the likelihood of claims, that going for the maximum would actually help in terms of being more straightforward, more simple, because you wouldn't have to start thinking about, you know, all your expectations. You just have, okay, well, I know the maximum in this period is this, is this, is this, and you don't need to go through the process of looking at expectations. So we thought that that would be simpler.
Okay. Well, looking at expectations in your liability, anyway, right? So you've probably got that more than you've got the maximum. The info about the maximum.
Well, the maximum in the policy, it's got to be in the contract.
Yeah, but you don't have it in a system. You know, you've got 1,000 contracts in a single group. Some are, you know, 1 year, some are 3 years, whatever, and you've got to go and pull that all together. Whereas for your cash flows, you've got it in your model, right?
Yeah, but it's mixed with the likelihood of a claim, so you can't just look at. I mean, that wouldn't, looking at the expected cash flows wouldn't get you to the answer that we think that IFRS 17 sets up. So you'd have to disentangle out of that expected cash flow what was due to the likelihood of a claim, which you'd ignore. I mean, that doesn't sound simpler to me than just looking at the maximum. But
also, all of the examples are at a single contract level, and I think the difficulty comes really when you are looking at a group. So how would you go about if you, let's say, even if you have two similar contracts to the one of your example, let's say two adverse development covers with a different duration, different limit and different profitability. Clearly, one coverage unit on one contract will not be equivalent to one coverage unit on the other because they will have different profit attached to them.
No, so the
you have to weigh different CSM. Attached. You have to allocate.
That doesn't affect the determination of the coverage units. If they're providing different levels of cover and they've got different durations, the two contracts will give rise to different coverage units.
Yeah.
But the profitability, you then apply that coverage unit to the CSM of the group as a whole. You don't track the CSM.
So are you looking to add them together without weighting them together in any way?
I think this is the important thing. I think this is perhaps so.
Because that's what I was aiming at. You know, do you add them together or do you weight them?
Coverage units comes about because essentially what the standard does is it requires you to group contracts, and once you group contracts, it removes the requirement to track the individual profitability. So essentially what you end up with is a pot of profit, and that profit attaches in some equal way to every single contract in the pot, no matter. So the argument here, and I think Anne's point about, we've taken off the table, the standard takes off the table, the idea that you can probability weight your cash flows. This is about the provision of service. So then what we're saying is, having now determined that every contract in this pot is equal, has an equivalent profitability, I've got to say equivalent profitability is what? An argument would be the sum assured is a what?
So a million rand contract has a million rand. £1 million, $1 million contract has a million of these units, and 100,000 contracts has 100,000 of these. Is one way of saying I allocate that profitability too. Now the argument here, I think, is that the standard clearly says you take probability off the table, so that's off the table. I'm taking probability off the table. Quantity of benefits mean? Yeah. I think what the argument here is quantity of benefits is clearly the gross benefit that the policyholder could expect to receive, irrespective of risk weightings. And I think that's where this paper is sort of heading. Mm-hmm.
Expect to receive.
Could receive maximum.
What is the gross amount? What is it? Irrespective of risk. If I take risk off the table, then I'm saying essentially it is the maximum.
So it's more of the maximum possible claim.
Well, and I think that's why Anne's
probable.
Yeah, and Anne's terminology of valid claims is an interesting one to just think through.
Yeah. Slightly different point.
Rachel?
Thank you, Martin. Recognizing the issue raised by other members here, we believe the current standard is sensible in allowing some flexibility for determining the coverage unit here, taking into account the quantity of benefits and the expected duration. Believe IFRS 17 is principle-based, and no further guidance is needed here. Different contracts require different profit release patterns to reflect the economics of the contract. So there's no one-size-fits-all solution. So we agree with the staff interpretation for this narrow set of examples. However, we note that some of the examples are for general insurance and not relevant for life insurance. This is important to note here, because we would not want to analogize to this here in subsequent discussion. Here. Finally, we appreciate the importance of contracts with investment components, and we are pleased to note that this will be further discussed here subsequently in future meetings. Here.
Okay, thanks. Leslie?
Thank you. To Daryl's point, I think the Canadians generally agreed with that's what the standard said, but made the observation that it implies that you will get a faster amortization of the CSM the more finely you group. In other words, if you go down to the individual contract level to establish a group, you will get a faster CSM amortization period than if you group. So just an observation there was some surprise that was actually the board's intent. To Kevin's point, we would not be comfortable using expected claims because of the implication that then on a life cover, the CSM amortization would be back-ended, would increase, so we preferred the level. On the point of the maximum, we had two examples where the maximum was maybe problematic. One is actually an example in the paper of the mortgage insurance, where the payment of the claim is net of the value of the property. We believe that the current value of the property should be used in establishing the current claim, the current stand ready amount of coverage, rather than the contractual maximum, which would be higher than that if the property level would drop. There's a similar issue with a life insurance contract where the death benefit is a face amount minus an account value. We would think it should be the current account value that establishes the coverage, as opposed to the potential maximum of if the account value drops to zero.
Leslie, I'm not sure I understood your point on the speed.
Oh, it's big. It's huge.
But why?
All right. Can I give you a simple example? This is a simple example that I've used. Okay. Let's say you've got two contracts, each with one unit of coverage, and each are 2 years long. Okay, so you got one. You got four coverage units at the beginning. At the end of the period, if everything goes as expected, you will have provided 2 years of cover, two units of cover, and have two left, so you will amortize half. That's all well and good. Now, let's say one of those contracts actually dies after the end of the first year, so you only have one unit of coverage remaining at the end of the first year. If you group those contracts together, the way I understand the standard is written, you will amortize two thirds in the first year because you provided 2 years of cover. You provided two units of cover, my apologies, and you have one left.
Yeah.
So you will amortize two-thirds. However, if they were separate contracts, for the first contract, you would amortize half because you provided, the guy who lived, you will provide, you have provided 1 year of coverage and have one remaining, so you will amortize half of his CSM. And for the contract that died, you have none left, you'd get 100%. So under that model, you would amortize three quarters. And this goes to William's point about the average duration. If you do use average duration, now the more finely you group the contract, the faster your amortization pattern. The expected duration in both cases is two, but once the person has died, their expected duration becomes zero. Sorry. I guess the point is the total number of coverage units under this model is not preserved. It's like you never did provide the four that were expected because the guy died early, as opposed to the other model, which says, no, if he dies, you actually consider that you provided all of his coverage in the first period.
How do they do that if you know that he died and the other one didn't?
Yeah.
So that was a problem that we faced, yes.
But I think you're probably right there. There's not just that, but there are clearly what we're doing with the standard in going for the group concept.
Yeah.
And specifically saying that we do not want you to track individual contract profitability, you accept what goes with averaging in that circumstance. So yes,
I think it's how you average actually was the question. How do you do the weighting and averaging? That does matter because if you choose different weights, you come up with different results.
But I think
to the point that William was making about the average duration.
Roman.
Yeah, maybe I'll just add on the discussion that if you add together different risks then in one group, that this could result then in kind of surprising or weird pattern. Also, if it's the same risk, it could be that you provide liability coverage and one contract has a maximum cover of 1 million, but in the liability space, you also provide a maximum cover of 100 million. And we have both contracts. And so if you have a look on the price difference, it's marginal. So if I have 1 million or 100 million cover, more or less the same price, or maybe 10-20% more. If I still would say I have no possibility to wait somehow, kind of, exposure of the company, I come to the conclusion that if I have a group of contracts with a lot of 1 million coverage and I add a little bit of 100 million coverage, then the earnings pattern changes dramatically. So I could even do a kind of earnings management, I would, with that possible maximum possible cover. So it feels really unnatural, and I cannot read it out of the standard. This is the only way to read it. So I see that expected cash flows are not the factor which needs to be taken, but that I can not allowed at all to take into account. Kind of exposure is difficult to accept, seeing the results and also reading the standards.
JV?
Thank you, Martin. I think I need to deliver what Korean life insurers are concerned about determining coverage unit, considering quantity of benefits and expected durations. Adding on Shelley Huang's explanation about the universal type of a contract, actually in Korea, our main product is the universal type of a contract, but the difference is that universal type is a base plan, but we have multiple insurance riders attached to the base plan. So what I'd like to say is the Korean product in nature is very complicated, it's very complex. So in that situation, it is really hard to estimate the quantity of benefits considering all these factors mentioned in this paper. So to ease the burden of insurers in implementing this IFRS 17, I think we need to think about the simpler way, liking within a group, there are a bunch of contracts with a different size, and within even a single contract, you know, there are a bunch of insurance riders attached. So to define, to determine the coverage unit exactly according to the what the step explaining about in this paper is almost impossible. So what I'm suggesting is, you know, we need to think about the simpler way, such as, you know, using passage of time to determine the coverage unit within a single contract, or we can just use, you know, the main risks of insurance component, you know, as a factor, as an indicator to determine to coverage unit in within a group. That's what I'm, you know, thinking of today's discussion. And also, I had a chance to meet with the Japanese insurers the other day, and they raised concerns about, you know, their way to determine the coverage unit, considering investment component are integral part of the, you know, today's product. So ISB, the TRG will be discussed on the investment component type later at the May meeting, right? But the final decision need to be concluded after.
Yeah.
That's why. Thank you.
Thank you. Francesco?
I would like to discuss the interaction between these principles in paragraph 17 and the requirement in paragraph 76, I think, from the recognition. Because, like Leslie, I've been thinking about what happens when things don't go as expected, which is all the time. And you know, the recognition, either the way that Leslie presented in that case was an acceleration of certain recognition, or it can go the other way around. In that case, you actually had the opposite. Instead of recognizing two-thirds, you recognize half instead of, because that person that was supposed to die next year dies later. So you're written in the standard that the number of coverage units for expected remaining coverage is adjusted to reflect the coverage units derecognized from the group. And the amount of the contractual service margin recognized in profit or loss in the period is based on the debt adjusted number applying paragraph B119. So when Leslie and I compared notes, we were coming to different conclusions on her example. I said to her, I think that if I read the way I should read it, 76C, I would take three units in year one, not two in a bit. And I would actually recognize three quarters of the total coverage units because of 76C. But then we have clearly a different perspective, and we agreed that she was going to raise that, and then I was going to say these.
Actually, my original thought was the same as Francesco's. It was that I found that everybody else thought I was wrong. It was about 75-25. About the people I surveyed, about 75% were reading it as if it would be two-thirds, and about a quarter of us were thinking it was three-quarters. So I concluded it wasn't clear, and we should talk about it.
It does say, so 76B says, the number of coverage units for expected remaining coverage is adjusted to reflect. So that, to me, gives...
Says the two that you used to expect comes down to one. Right. But the question is, if the amount of coverage provided during the year is the expected future coverage at the beginning of the year minus the expected future coverage at the end of the year. Well, but that's a natural thing to think of, right? Like, I had an expected future...
That's because you have requested us to go back effectively at the beginning of the period in order to keep it consistent with all the future periods.
Well, what we say at the end of the period, you think about what you actually did provide
in the period.
In the period, and what you now expect to provide in the future.
Yes.
So
your opening balance doesn't matter ever.
So the opening balance at the beginning of the period doesn't matter.
Yeah, because you always have to recalculate it based on the closing period.
Yes.
That's the way to read 76C. 76C effectively makes you true up the adjustments expected to reflect what happened in the period.
Just 76C is just reiterating the requirement that's set out in B119. 76 doesn't include any new requirements.
No, but you don't talk about it in the paper. We noticed in our own discussion that people are actually forgetting about it. Okay. I thought that we would do this double act and talk about it.
No, that's good. We will record all of that, so it's recorded.
Then at least we have one clarification. Laura?
Thank you, Martin. First, there is one comment that was made earlier, but important to have a global view on things in this encompassing products having an investment component. I think a good example was mentioned, the example of a deferred annuity. And I think it's a complex one. With respect to the conclusions of the staff which are highlighted in paragraph 17, I would tend to agree to capture expected duration. On the discussion we're having, I wonder to what extent all this is influenced by the possible difference we would have between expected mortality, for instance, and actual experience. And to me, it would not be unreasonable to have some reactivity on this expected duration. On conclusion B, which reflects some variability in the level of cover, I think it's totally sensible to me. And then on the last one, many people that are in this room, I'm slightly uncomfortable because the maximum level of cover could be one element to take into account, but it's not a perfect one. I tend to think that if we agree that we need to take out the likelihood of the occurrence of a claim, then we might want to consider the expected level of cover. I think in the paper we take the example of 5 cover for a building. The cover is constant at 50 million, but the value of the building is increasing over time. In this example, I tend to think that the driver should also increase over time.
Yeah. Joe?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a really difficult area, and I agree that I think we probably need to look at it when we've got the investment bits alongside it. My reading was I agree with the principle that we're trying to establish that it, you know, we should be differentiating between the probability of a claim. So I agreed with that. But then when you start looking at the examples, you know, it just becomes really difficult to apply in practice. And I think, you know, for the adverse development cover, we would absolutely expect to be recognising the most of the profit over the early years, because the service that we think we're providing tends to align with, you know, with the payment of claims. So if you've got, you know, typically you'll have 90% will be settled in the first 5 years, but it could be 30 or 50 years for the remaining 10%. And so you need some kind of pattern that reflects that. I think, you know, similarly where you've got deferred annuities, that's quite difficult to think, you know, you're clearly providing a service from the minute you take on the contract, which I think is the you're then on risk for any development in longevity risk up until the point in which you start paying out the claims. You know, you need to find some kind of coverage that reflects that and will, you know, spread your profit over the whole length of the contract. I think it's you know, when you start looking, there's such a range of different types of contracts that it's actually quite difficult to apply the principles in practice and to, you know, identify coverage units that align with how we think, you know, economically we're earning the profit. So I think it's something that we needs a bit more thought, and I think we probably need to come back to when we see the investment piece as well.
Darren.
No, sorry.
I just wanted to echo that I'd agree that, you know, B119 does say you have to consider duration, so I don't think we can get out of that. But I'm not entirely sure whether we actually were able to conclude on what exactly benefit represents, and I agree with Roman that it's not necessarily just coverage, because if you look at the way that the standard reads, you allocate contractual service margin to reflect the service provided, and it's not necessarily equal to coverage. So I'd also agree that we need to revisit that in the context of investment component as well.
I wonder, given some of the diversity of thinking, and I think some good ideas that have been raised and some points that I wouldn't mind chatting to the staff about, and given we were already coming back with investment components, whether that gives us an opportunity rather than sort of drawing too much out of this discussion to sort of reflect, come back for the more complete package for the next meeting, I think is what some people are suggesting. I thought coverage was pretty key, just to respond to that last comment. What I would like to think about a little bit more is the point that Anne Driver made about the validity of the claim point. Yeah. I think we were trying to be kind by not making people think about the value of things changing over time, but maybe that's not a good idea. And also, I know, Martin, we had a conversation the other day about how strictly we really meant the contractual limit. So if you had a situation where you said that the contractual limit on a, I don't know, mortgage guarantee was 50 million flat, and you knew that the loan was an amortizing loan, then of course we didn't really mean 50 million, because you'd have to look but beyond that and sort of say, well, really your contractual obligation is a declining one. That feels a little bit like the validity concept that Anne is saying, talking about. So I don't know fully, but I think it's worth exploring. I think we've got the opportunity to go and have a look at it again.
I would also agree to that. I mean, does it make sense to go through the examples now? I don't think so, because maybe, or do you think we should? Because I think
well,
we have.
With the next stage, I suppose, is the main question.
I would.
It might help us pick up some more points we need to think about.
Okay.
Because we've got them all here ready to talk to us.
Yeah.
And I'm really a bit concerned if we give now too much guidance thoughts about issues which we maybe in the next meeting
change our mind.
If
people could send me their comments
on the examples,
and then I could look at that and develop a paper that also looked at investment components and draw together, you know, the operational complexity. So the key point seemed to be that there was concern about using the maximum level of cover rather than the expected level of cover. So not the expected level of claims, but the expected level of cover. To think about the operational complexity, to think about the level of detail that we ought to be getting into given the very wide variety of products, and also to think about how investment components fit into all of this.
Yeah. I think there was also the point about it's actually amortization for a group, so it's kind of hard to do at the contract level.
Yeah.
And then
think of it as a group because you've already lost some of the contract and went to a group.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, thank you.
No summary, but we have an action to come back to you.
We have an action.
You agreed to come back.
Summarize the facts.
By the end of the month.
Sorry?
By the end of February?
Will the summary be published?
No.
When will we like our comments back?
It would be good, because maybe
we still have to write it.
Try to discuss it again in May. And
by the end of this month.
Yes, that would be very helpful. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Anne.